On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American founding father Thomas Jefferson knew a lot about music, architecture, revolution, slaves, philosophy, governing, and wine. Jefferson was far and away the young nation's wine lover in chief. He advised sober George Washington on what to drink, kept fabulous wine cellars when the country was still the province of hard cider and whiskey, braved pirates and hurricanes to see his favorites across the high seas, roamed the vineyards of France until he knew them like home. Today, Americans like never before have made wine part of their lives and culture, but Jefferson may still be our first best guide. Later this hour, we'll hear from master sommelier and author Andrea Robinson, and we'll pull a few corks with Jack Beattie to taste what Jefferson loved. But first, the man himself and his life in wine. I'm joined from Greenwood, Mississippi by John Heilman. He's a former wine columnist for the Washington Post. He's judged international wine competitions for 20 years, and he's just out with a remarkable account of the author of the Declaration of Independence and the Fruit of the Vine. His new book is Thomas Jefferson on Wine. John Heilman, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
So give us a profile of Thomas Jefferson as the sort of founding father of America's relationship with wine.
Well, he was remarkable. Of course, he had, as you say, so many interests, but wine was one of his keenest interests. One of his first neighbors was Philip Mazze from Tuscany, and Mazze taught him about Italian wines, Italian reds especially, also whites. They started a vineyard together. Francis Fauquier, who was a French Huguenot governor of Virginia, had a huge wine cellar. He taught Jefferson about wine, and also the most surprising, the Hessian prisoners of war that were quartered in Charlottesville, who were captured in New York, they taught Jefferson about German wines. They were very musical, and he would have them to his house. He was trying to co-opt them to join the American side against the English. So he had a lot of sources to learn about wine early in life.
We want to travel along with Thomas Jefferson as he got his wine education. It's quite remarkable, and you go into enormous detail through France and all the rest. We'll look at that. But remind us first, and we're going to have fun in this hour, too. I've got three bottles sitting on the table before me, and we're going to pull a few corks before we're finished here. But remind us.
We
do, too. But Mississippi's not a bad place to be. Remind us of what the wine life of the early American Republic was like. I mean, there was very little in the way of grape cultivation and wine production in this country then.
That's true. They didn't have any of the vinifera or European grapes. And getting wine across the ocean when it was either too hot or too cold, the wine would often spoil. So most of what they drank had a lot of either brandy or sugar or both added as a preservative. So the wines they drank early were much different from ours. Now, Jefferson was the first one to try to bring in European wines in their natural state without too much sweetness and without too much brandy. And he was successful. He had them shipped at the right seasons. And I do have in the book some tavern lists, what they call ordinary lists, to show surprisingly a broad variety of wines from all over Europe were available right before the American Revolution.
You had Mission wines out in California, but of course that wasn't part of the picture at all. That was still Spanish and kind of another world. I loved your descriptions of what was involved in getting barrels of wine from Europe to young America in those days. The storms, the pirate, the heat, the guys on the Potomac who would knock open the barrel and chug it down and deliver river water.
Jefferson was always a colorful writer. He called the pirates who robbed his wines the lawless rovers of the ocean. And on the rivers, he called them the rascally boatmen who would tap his barrels and drink his wine. So he was frustrated, but he was 90% successful.
He got, teased, to say the least. Patrick Henry charged that Jefferson abjured his native victuals. a wine snob was Patrick Henry's kind of implicit charge there. A fair charge?
Well, I finally concluded that he sounded a lot like a wine snob when he was in France, and when he got back in America, that was so unpopular to be like this that I finally concluded he was more of a wine bore. He sort of ran the subject into ground. John Quincy Adams said in a letter that he had dinner at the White House when Jefferson was president and said, much discussion of wine, not very illuminating.
Enough of that already, Tom. But Jefferson, as you say, he kind of had his obsessions, and wine a big one. Describe what happened when Jefferson finally made it to France representing the young republic, and how he opened up his awareness of, understanding of wines once there, and the phenomenal record that he made of that that romance with wine.
Well, he kept a meticulous record of everything he did. He wrote them on little ivory notebooks he kept in his pocket, and about once a week he would transcribe his notes into formal written memorandum books, big memorandum books. But he, when he first got to Paris, one of the first things that happened was a huge cask of red wine from Gaillac arrived for Adams, and he didn't know where it came from or what to do with it, so he and Abigail wrote back and forth, and finally he came to really like that wine, which is not far from where I have a house in France now. It's a wine that would do well to be better known in America. Then he immediately began going to dinner parties, and Franklin had a huge wine cellar, very varied. And between Adams and Franklin, they actually introduced Jefferson to wines, but he quickly surpassed both of them and became the biggest expert.
So he went off on one big jaunt in, what, 1784?
In 1787.
Seven. Mm-hmm.
He was having a little romance with this blonde beauty from Italy named Maria Cosway.
His wife had died. He was a widower at that point.
Right. He never cheated on his wife. He was very straight. His wife had been dead several years. Mm-hmm. He was, anyway, during something, he broke his wrist, and it was set badly, and he was in a lot of pain. So he thought he'd go to Aix-en-Provence and try the mineral waters. But his daughter sort of chuckled about it. Yeah, right, yeah. It just happened.
Mineral waters.
Every vineyard from, it was March 1787, he started down through Burgundy, then through the Rhone Valley, through Provence, all the way across southern France, stops at Marseille, visits all these cellars, tasting wine and making notes on it everywhere he went. Also writing letters back and forth to his friends in Paris, telling them what he's tasting. Then he ends up spending about a week in Bordeaux, up the coast, through the Loire Valley, commenting on the wines in the Loire Valley, all the way back to Paris.
Give us a sense of Thomas Jefferson direct from his notes, if you'd be good enough, John Hailman, there. May 24th, Bordeaux.
Well, in, let's see, would you like me to, I've got a section here.
Sure, please, if you could read from the man himself.
All right, May 24, Bordeaux. When we crossed the Garonne River at Langon, which I did last year on a ferry, they still have a car ferry there, we find the plains entirely of sand and gravel, and they continue so to Bordeaux. Where they are capable of anything, they are in vines. Near Langon is Sauternes, where the best white wines of Bordeaux are made. The elm tree shows itself at Bordeaux peculiarly proper for being spread flat for arbors. Many are done in this way on the Quai de Chartrand, which is still the center of the Bordeaux wine trade. May 24 to 28, in Bordeaux. The cantons in which the most celebrated wines of Bordeaux are made are Médoc, down the river toward the Atlantic, and Grave, adjoining the city, and the parishes next above, all on the same side of the river. In the first is made red wine principally, in the two last, white wine. The grafting of the vine, though a critical operation, is practiced with success. When the graft is taken, they bend it into the earth and let it root above the scar. They begin to yield an indifferent wine at 3 years old, but not a good one until 25 years old, nor after 80, when they begin to yield less and worse and must be renewed. They dung a little the ground in Médoc and Grave because of the poverty of the soil, but very little, as more would affect the wine, the taste. The Journal, that's an area, yields communibus annus in a typical year, about three pièces or 200 and 250 bottles each. The vineyards of first quality are all worked by their proprietors. Those of the second quality rent for 300, the Journal. Those of the third at 200. They employ a kind of overseer at 400 or 500 pounds a year, finding him lodging and drink, but he feeds himself. He superintends and directs, but is expected to work but little. If the proprietor has a garden, the overseer tends that. They never hire laborers by the year. the day wages for a man are 30 sous, a woman's 15 sous feeding themselves. The women make the bundles of salmon, that is vine shoots, weed, pull off the snails, tie the vines, gather the grapes. During the vintage, they are paid high and fed well.
Thomas Jefferson in Bordeaux, and with his eye on every little nuance, partly in hope, John Heilman, you write, that he could one day see this propagated in the United States.
Absolutely. He was. There's a whole chapter of the book about his vineyards, how he tries and tries, and also it's updated to now where the Thomas Jefferson Foundation has replanted both of his vineyards very successfully. And their winemaker, a really fine Italian winemaker named Gabriele Rousse, has made some really good Sangiovese, the main grape of Chianti. So they're having quite a success. They learned how to graft grapes, which Jefferson never tried. That plus chemicals are the secret of their success.
My guest is John Heilman. He's author of the new book, Thomas Jefferson on Wine. I mean, today, everybody seems to be in the wine game, in the wine appreciation realm. The 2004 hit film Sideways had a big impact on the American wine market because of the main character's distaste for Merlot. Sales of that wine dropped, while sales of Pinot Noir, his favorite wine, spiked. In this little clip, Miles, played by Paul Giamatti, talks about why he thinks the Pinot Noir grape is special.
It's a hard grape to grow, as you know, right? It's thin-skinned, temperamental, ripens early. It's, you know, it's not a survivor like Cabernet, which can just grow anywhere and thrive even when it's neglected. No, Pinot needs constant care and attention.
Paul Giamatti in Sideways. John Heilman, in Thomas Jefferson's day, in the young United States of America, was there that kind of conversation, that kind of intimate, you know, thread-by-thread, flavor-by-flavor conversation about wine, the grape?
Well, there was at Thomas Jefferson's table and at Monticello, I think probably not too many other places, but he definitely, we know he did because his granddaughters wrote about it and he wrote about it. They had often served as what he called table drinks, either wine diluted with water or hard cider or beer. But after dinner, especially, Americans like to sit and taste their good wines and discuss them. George Washington discussed them quite a bit. Hamilton discussed it. Adams was a big wine lover and liked to talk about wine. So it's really funny. We're getting back to our roots. I think they were more interested in wine back then than Americans were in the 19th century.
We're gonna pull a cork on at least one that Thomas Jefferson might recognize and look at some more contemporary wines in a moment. Let me take a call first from Norfolk, Virginia, down getting toward Jefferson Way. Glenn's calling. Hi, Glenn. You're on the air.
Hi. Jefferson, a friend of mine was making wine at Virginia Beach.
Mm-hmm.
He's long dead. He went to the Library of Congress to read some of the books on wine, some of the rare books. He came across a book by John Adlam, and inside the book, John Adlam raised Catawba grapes and popularized the Catawba grapes throughout America in the colonies. And the Catawba grapes made terrible wine. They were muscadines, and they, of course, were the source of the phylloxera that wiped out the European wine industry practically in the 19th century. But anyway, there was a note from Jefferson tucked in to the book, which my friend drew to the attention of the security people at the library.
Yes, here's Jefferson's own hand, right?
And in it, Jefferson wrote the writing to his friend John Adlam, who and said, praise the Catawba wine which John Adlam had made.
Yes.
And sent to him. And in my friend's mind, somewhat amusingly, played with the thought that Jefferson's taste in wine was just terrible because the Catawba grape, for all its other merits, like all the other muscadines, made just terrible wine.
But maybe Jefferson was just being the diplomat with it, with his friend's wine.
I absolutely believe he was being polite. John Adlam is a major figure, his vineyard was there where the Naval Observatory is.
Oh, yeah. Glenn, it's a wonderful story. Let us put it to John Heilman. John, what do you hear? Jefferson being diplomatic about the wine his friend offered him?
I agree totally with both of you, which is unusual for a lawyer. I think Jefferson was being polite. I actually have a reproduction in the illustrations in the book of that letter. It was kind of embarrassing. Oh, my gosh, is Jefferson, this was when he was in his late 70s,
yeah.
Has he lost his palate? But I think when you read him overall, he was always excessively polite. And when somebody offered him something, he seldom gave him a rude answer. He always tried to say something nice. So I think that's probably the answer there. Charles Francis Adams, it's his great-grandson, I believe, wrote a history of Jefferson's presidency and was a keen observer. I think he had him where I said, Jefferson, there's always a vague aura of duplicity about some of his statements because he just tried not to offend people. He always said he tended to speak in superlatives and positives.
Right. He made a lot of records of this. You remind us that he used what they called, is it a polygraph machine with holding two quills? So he would write his notes and letters, and they'd be copied precisely on another piece of paper. So we've got a lot of this. What do we know about Jefferson's taste in wine? We're going to compare it a little later, perhaps to our taste today. But what were his favorites? Where did his tastes run, John?
That was how I really got started on the book, Tom, was to trace them from his youth when he was drinking mainly Madeira, because that's what was there. But he noted when he was a student that George Wythe's wife would take ordinary Madeira and pour in 1/10 superfine Malmsey and greatly improve it. So he was interested in blending when he was very young.
Mm-hmm.
And as he progressed, like most people, he went from stronger wines to more subtle wines. And he basically liked his wines drier than his friends and contemporaries. He would keep, like Richard Nixon, kept his Bordeaux for himself wrapped in a napkin and would serve cheaper wines to
everybody else. Right?
Jefferson put them out. He said, you converse at your ease and drink as you please. And he let everybody, he would always present a buffet of wines and let people taste and choose what they liked. But when he would drink, they would insist on drinking what he drank. His neighbor, Colonel Carter, told Madison, said, you've got to get Jefferson to stop drinking these cold, acid French wines. They're going to ruin his health. Get him something less acidic. So from a novice's standpoint, they often call a wine that's dry, they call it acid. So I think he had a better palate than his contemporaries. But he did like everything. He liked sherry. He drank a lot of Portuguese wines. He drank Mosels from Germany, Montepulciano, a red from the Tuscany region. That was one of his real favorites. He had just like in everything else, he was interested in every possible sensation.
Wine has had a kind of a rough go between Jefferson's time and not so long ago in this country. I mean, for a long time, despite being called Vinland by the Viking travelers, that there wasn't much in the way of winemaking grape here, and then we had the San Francisco earthquake. I'm reading somewhere, millions of barrels of California wine destroyed. Then came Prohibition, and things almost put out of business. Would the American wine life today be recognizable to Thomas Jefferson?
Oddly, Tom, I think it would. We've made a comeback. It started with soldiers, GIs returning from World War II, who had seen European wines and wanted to drink them in America. And then in the 60s and 70s, waves of American tourists went to Europe and tried wines, loved them. And in California, in Oregon and Washington, they had the climate, and they started making wines like European wines, using European grapes. Now you have all 50 states having wineries, including, for example, upstate New York has great Rieslings, and they have a fine sparkling wine made in New Mexico. So all over the United States, they're making good wine now. Virginia.
Yeah, Virginia and all 50 states I read recently, which is kind of remarkable. Hawaii and Alaska, but I guess they've got some. We're at 800-423-8255. We're looking at Americans and wine from Thomas Jefferson to right now. Rob's calling from Plattsburgh, New York. Hi, Rob, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well.
I want to make a case for a revolution that's going on in winemaking, viticulture these days. And that is the advent of northern regions coming in with hybrid wines, not vinifera, but vinifera hybridized with American species.
Yeah.
Much more appropriate for the continental U.S., and makes a good set of wines, not necessarily exactly vinifera flavors, but a new set of toys to play with.
John Heilman, is that something that Thomas Jefferson anticipated or would recognize?
He wanted European wines. Then there'd be a war, like the War of 1812, when he couldn't get in. He'd say, maybe we should go back to American vines. So hybrids are an interesting compromise. Some of the best ones I've had actually are like at Chateau, Asheville, the Vanderbilt.
Mm-hmm. Estate there?
Yeah, the Biltmore Estate.
Biltmore, excuse me. Mm-hmm.
They do some blending like that. They get some grapes from California, and they have or North Carolina now has a vinifera or European grape industry. But I tend to think, Jefferson might have been interested in one called Norton. It's not Catawba. It's a different species, Vitis estivalis, they call it. In Missouri and in Virginia, they're making some very interesting red wines. It's a Native American grape, but it's not like muscadine. It has a totally different flavor. I find that blended with some European grapes or with some hybrids makes a good wine. Although I guess I lean more toward grafting European grapes. Even in New York, Washington, wherever, I think grafting European vines onto American roots is probably still the best.
Ellen's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
First, I have one comment before I ask a question. I'm a member of an international group called the Commanderie de Bordeaux, which is really a society about the appreciation of Bordeaux wine. And at the beginning of each of our dinner meetings, there are some ceremonial toasts to the President of the United States, to the
yes.
President of France,
yeah.
And then there's one to Thomas Jefferson.
Great. He lives.
And I didn't know if the author knew of this group and our great affiliation with Thomas Jefferson.
And your further question, Ellen.
Okay, the question is, you just mentioned Sideways.
Sure, the movie.
There was another movie that came out about the same time about the globalization of wine called Mondo Vino, and it concerned a lot about Robert Parker and everyone going after his praise.
The kind of homogenization of taste right. globally in wine, yeah.
And I was wondering what your guest, after all of his research, would think Thomas Jefferson would think about the Parker rating system.
John Heilman, there's two on the table. The toasts are still up there for Thomas Jefferson. And what about Mondo Vino and the charge of homogenization globally here?
That's a pretty tough series of questions all put together, but I'll try them. The Commanderie of Bordeaux, maybe they'll invite me to join. I would love it. No, it's a great organization. A good friend of mine, Peter Seychelle, has been the head of it in New York. I'm talking about him in the book. It's a great organization. I love those.
Mm.
I'm a member of one of them in Beaujolais.
And still toasting your man. And what about Mondo Vino?
Well, I was going to say about toasting. It's funny, ironically, Jefferson was opposed to excessive toasting. Thought people, you should be able to drink whenever
just drink
you like.
It. Right, right.
There's a whole section of the book about the Republic of Georgia today where they still have the formal toasting like we had in the 18th century. But I love a good toast or two or three, and I'm happy they toast Jefferson.
Yeah.
Mondo Vino, I think overall, looking at the whole globalization of wine, in the first instance, I think it's improved it. There's a lot of places I've been, like Moldova or the Republic of Georgia, where they needed modernization, or even Spain and Portugal. Once they get it, I think then they tend to step back and say, wait a minute, we're not going to make a uniform wine like Coke, like everybody else. Then I think they tend to go back to their roots, start finding their own original grapes. So I think it's globalization is sort of a passing thing, and Jefferson would have thought, well, at the beginning it's good, and we'll grow through this, and eventually people will want local wines and with local flavors and microclimates. And so I think it's just a stage you go through. Even when I wrote my wine column those 20-some years, I never gave numbers. I never believed in that.
As in rating numbers, you know.
Right. Although when I judge wines, we kind of rate them by gold, silver, bronze, an honorable mention. But Parker has done a lot to modernize and popularize wine and make it available to people. I don't quite share his tastes always, but I think he's been a positive force. People, it's just a stage we're going through.
All right, we're going to dive in here in just a second and actually pour a little wine. And there's one we've got that you've described, John Heilman, as one that Thomas Jefferson himself would actually have pretty much known and known well. This is the Hermitage. Can you describe it for us and describe Jefferson's relationship?
Right. We tend to think of Hermitage as a red Syrah from the Rhone Valley. That's the one we think of most. Even back in Jefferson's time, they made more red than white. But from the grapes Roussanne and Marsanne, they make a great white wine, which they also make in Switzerland. I used to taste it there, called Hermitage without the H. It's a beautiful wine. You can get Chateauneuf du Pape from France that's white that says on the label it's all Roussanne. Mrs. Rideau from Louisiana, who emigrated to California, Rideau Vineyard, she made a Roussanne that won 2 years ago at the L.A. County Fair as the greatest white wine in the world, beating out several, you know, all the European wines and the California Chardonnay. So I think Jefferson's taste was really great. He loved this wine and got and ordered it whenever he could.
All right. In a moment, we're going to drink a little bit of this wine. Jack Beattie, our news analyst here, and today our wine connoisseur, is joining us from up in New Hampshire. Jack, are you there?
Yes, Tom. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one on-point staffer to pursue his libational happiness before noon, he pledges his life, his fortune, and his sacred honor to accomplish that giddy task. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Jack. The call of duty is there. We hear you responding.
Sir.
Jack, can you imagine Thomas Jefferson looking out across this great country today at all the wine that gets quaffed and saying, oh, my gosh, talk about a revolution. Here it is.
You know, he would have said, this is the pursuit of happiness, and I'm all for it. And to think that it's native now, I think that would have delighted him, that America, every state, even Alaska, has its own wine. I think that would have delighted him.
We're talking this hour about Americans and wine from Thomas Jefferson to 2006. Right now, our guest has been John Heilman. He's author of Thomas Jefferson on Wine. It's a compendium of Jefferson's life with wine, and it was a very deep, detailed, and of course, since it's Jefferson, well-recorded one of his travels through France and Germany and Italy, of his travails in getting wine still in the barrel across the ocean and onto his table in the White House and at Monticello. Jack Beattie, our on-point news analyst, is with us right now. We're going to begin to dip into a little bit of this. And I've also got on-point producer Tanya Raleigh with me in the studio. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Tom.
We've got some wine on the table. Tanya knows a little bit about this. She produces all kinds of shows for us, but is a graduate of the French Culinary Institute in New York City. Her dad's a restaurateur, big in Chicago, Gibson's, and all the rest. John Heilman, we have on the table here this Hermitage. Tell us once more about it. Where is it from exactly? When would Thomas Jefferson have had it in his glass, and should it taste the same today?
Oh, well, on the last question, I'm not sure it would taste exactly the same, but I suspect very much the same. Jefferson actually got on a mule and climbed to the top of Hermitage, which is a hill supposedly named for a hermit who came back from the Crusades and stayed up there. But it's a little town called Tins, T-E-I-N-S, overlooking the Rhone River. And it was once almost extinct. It became so, the white was so rare, but now just like in the same region, you have Viognier. Suddenly, Viognier is very popular. I'm hoping that as they rediscover Jefferson's wines, the Roussanne grape and the Marsanne grape, its partner in the wine, will start to be planted all over California and Oregon and Washington. I hope it'll become as popular as Viognier has lately, and Chardonnay even.
All right, here goes a first for us. Tanya, let's pour a little bit. Jack, I think you're at the ready there in New Hampshire.
I am indeed.
Yes, I hear it. I hear it. The sipping's going to be very slight indeed at this hour of the day. That's way more than we'll do. Jack, all right, our first on-air wine tasting. Jack, are you ready to put this one to your lips?
Yes, sir. Here's to you.
Here's to you, my friend. Best of the season. Here we go.
I wish I could join you all.
Yes, all right. All right, Jack, we'll get your response. John Hellman, take us into the flavors that you know of this Hermitage wine that we're undoubtedly tasting right now.
It's a very, very subtle wine, but it has a good body. It should be drunk with food. It's meant to be drunk with food, but Jefferson actually always ordered his as ripe as possible, meaning he wanted a little bit of a touch of sweetness, he called it, which would be like a Kendall Jackson Chardonnay nowadays has like 1% residual sugar. It should be like that. So it's very pleasant drinking by itself, although it's meant to be drunk with food.
All right, Jack, keep it on your palate there. What do you make of this one? Wonderful smell, a bouquet, they say.
Yes, and there's no bad aftertaste. There's no aftertaste seemingly at all. There's no... It is so smooth, and I mean, this couldn't give heartburn to the most sensitive heart. And you know, you realize what a fairly expensive wine is like. It has these properties of just immediate drinkability, and smoothness. That's just the way I would put it.
And all kinds of nice little complexity on the way across the tongue there. I want to bring in a real pro at this as we think about how Thomas Jefferson might have had this wine. Joining us from Berkeley, California, having made it through some heck of a traffic jam out there, Andrea Robinson is with us. She's Master Sommelier, Dean of Wine Studies at the French Culinary Institute in New York, author of Wine Made Simple and Andrea Robinson's 2007 Wine Buying Guide for Everyone. Andrea, thanks for having battled your way to the studio there. Great to have you.
Hey, thank you. It's great to be here, finally.
Yes. So Jack and I are lucky to have this Hermitage, much as Thomas Jefferson would have had these couple hundred plus years ago. Tell us about this wine, and is there a then and now story you can imagine here, Andrea? Is it essentially the same item?
You know, it essentially is. I mean, nowadays, I think, you know, it's interesting that you were talking about the that Jefferson would have liked it with a little touch of sweetness, because I think that there has been the trend towards the riper style in this modern day with wine. So probably it's as though the American palate has evolved, I guess, back around to what Thomas Jefferson would have enjoyed. But this is a really classic wine with, you know, real subtlety. You mentioned that there's not a bad aftertaste, and that's really, I think, the claim to fame of this style of wine, because they don't overdo and just sort of let the grapes in the soil express itself.
Easy to imagine this on an American table today. John Hellman, this is one that Thomas Jefferson could sit right down for dinner and feel completely at home with.
Oh, he'd be delighted. Actually, Dennis Horton, who has the old Montdomain winery there, not too far from Charlottesville, experimented with Marsan, but he had problems with the climate and finally gave it up. But they're doing really well with it in California, especially on the central coast. So I'm hoping, and the ones I've tasted are equal to the Hermitages of France. I think my very favorites I ever tasted are from Switzerland. They grow it there in small quantities. But I think it has a great future. I hope people... I loved Andrea. I can't plug my book, but I loved Andrea's book. I just finished reading it. And,
thank you.
It's very practical and straightforward. I agree with her judgments.
We're going to keep the corks pulling here. We've got, looking at American tastes and bringing them up to date, we've got a Pinot Noir here. Andrea, what is your general sense of the direction of American taste in wine? You say back around to something more robust, like what Jefferson would have liked? What does that say about Merlot, Pinot Noir, and that journey?
You know, it's a great time, I think, for the American wine consumer, and also kind of in spite of the trends towards, I think, big, robust tastes that are really inspired by critics that give high scores to these big, powerful wines. By the same token, even though consumers are certainly influenced by bigger, bolder styles and the high scores that they get when they get rated by a critic, they're also embracing more subtle styles and more diverse styles, because right now the grapes that are on fire are, for example, Pinot Noir, to your point, and its white wine counterpart, Pinot Grigio. They're both growing with double-digit percentage increases in sales. And so that says to me, because they're both subtle grapes that Americans are embracing a wide array of styles, including those more subtle or elegant ones that are more suited maybe to matching to food, where that's really they show their best.
All right, let's pour a little here. Tanya's got the bottle. Jack's at the ready. Andrea Robinson, we're pouring a Fire Steed Pinot Noir. This is from Oregon, 2004 vintage. What can you tell us about it?
This is a great little wine. Fire Steed, they just do, this is one of my favorites in the wine buying guide because year in and year out, you can count on it for quality. And a lot of times people are concerned, especially Americans, think, oh, I've got to get the right year. Which year should I go for? And very often, wines that are at you know, an everyday price point are like food in the supermarket. You get what's fresh. And so what I love about Fire Steed is it really shows the Oregon Pinot Noir character, which is oftentimes really smoky in the scent. And then on the palate, it's really silky as opposed to big and gripping. It's soft and like lingerie for your tongue rather than, you know, like a baseball mitt. I mean, really very subtle.
Jack, lingerie for the tongue. Here's looking at you, kid. Let's try this one. Here we go. Yeah, soft right there for sure. And? Yes. Jack, raspberry, cherry, violets, farmyard, truffles, smoke, lingerie. What have you got there?
Smoke for sure.
You're probably going to get a good tangy acidity on the palate, too, which is the real claim to fame for that grape. It makes it so good with food because acidity really sort of launches the flavor in foods that you're pairing with the wine.
Even a little cranberry there you've written.
Yeah, you can feel that. It's a, you know, as E.B. White might have said, it's a simple wine with ambitions to pretension.
and not so heavy on the wallet either. Tanya, what did this one run? Do you recall?
Yeah, this was $12.99 at the local wine store.
So within range of the everyman budget, very nice. Andrea, what do you have to spend these days? I mean, then we're talking about presidents and ambassadors and founders of the nation with great estates. Can every man afford a decent, good wine these days?
Yes, that's my favorite story of the, you know, modern day American wine market is that it's such a buyer's market because there's such a global business for wine. There's great wine now grown just about everywhere that it's not tropical or freezing cold. And as a result, the prices are really competitive and the quality at an everyday price point. So call it $10 a bottle in the typical market. But in some really competitive markets, you can find excellent wines that, you know, are competing heavily at $5.99 and $6.99. And when you put them in a brown bag and you don't tell everybody how much they are and you just give them a glass and they say, wow, this is really good. And then you say, great, it's $6.99. Then they're like, wait a minute, what's wrong with me? Do I like cheap wine? But the fact is that it doesn't have to be expensive to be good. And that's great news.
John Hahnemann, Thomas Jefferson was not shy about putting the resources of the young United States to work in the White House and elsewhere on wine. But as he got older and his debts grew, there was no endless budget anymore for even the founder.
Right. He started off with his Burgundies with Chambertin, and he moved down to Pommard, and he kept getting less and less expensive wines. He found acceptable substitutes, and as late as 1824, when Lafayette came back from France as an old man and made a tour all over the United States, he and his party, his family, they drank up Jefferson's wine cellar. They thought it was, he obviously thought his inexpensive wines were still very good wines. So Daniel Webster and many other people visited Jefferson and left comments on the wine, which I put in the book. So it's apparent that today, like yesterday, in Jefferson's time, you can drink extremely well in America and very modestly. Of course, his big thing was that wine is healthier than whiskey or brandy.
Right.
He said no nation is drunken where wine is cheap. And he said that a tax on wine is a tax on the health of our citizens. It's a prohibition. Little did he know what he was predicting.
That we would actually have. He said wine the only antidote to the bane of whiskey. go to wine, my friend. Let's take a call from Monroe, Connecticut. And John, hi, John, you're on the air. I'm loving this Fire Steed 2004 from Oregon. Wonderful. John, what are you drinking? What are you hearing, Thomas Jefferson?
Oh, I tell you, I'm enjoying your program immensely, and I'm so happy I caught your program. Just having been to Monticello some years back, it was just by chance the day that Mr. Gorbachev was there, so it must be a good 15 years or so ago.
Yeah.
But, as part of our American heritage here, I feel like a bit of a connection to Jefferson and Monroe. They were neighbors. And having married a girl from Italy some 30 years ago, my taste buds have come along, I think, that her father now approves of my selections. But I'm glad to hear Jefferson had a little bit of a selection for his guests, because at my table I try to put out two or three wines with dinner, and I invite people. I said, well, try several of them, try them all. I said, take your taste buds to the big dance.
Take your taste buds to the big dance. And there may be Thomas Jefferson himself doing a reel. We've got one more. John, thanks for that call. We've got one more we're going to try here. Jack, Andre, this is a, well, Tanya, describe it. What have we got here? What are you pouring?
We have here a Malbec, mm-hmm. and it's a Catena Malbec from Argentina.
Argentina, so way south of the equator. Malbec, my little list here says violet fruit. What should we expect in this one, Andrea?
You know, exactly that. It is a grape that originally hails from Bordeaux in France, which was one of Jefferson's, of course, favorite wine sources. And it is one of the grapes that is a partner to the really popular Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot grapes. In Bordeaux, it's typically blended with those in minor quantities. But in Argentina's Mendoza district, which is a very big and very vibrant and growing wine, fine wine district, it's the signature red. And what you would expect is, or what you should expect in the taste, is something similar to Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot. Mm. But you mentioned violets, and that is a bit of a signature with the Malbec grape. A lot of times people are, you know, a lot of people, the only violet they've ever beheld is like an African violet, which doesn't have any fragrance. So they're like, what do violets smell like? But you might think of really dark plums and blueberry, and then usually a bit of an earthy scent that reminds me of sort of like cocoa powder that's not sweetened, like not the stuff you mix in your milk, but the stuff you bake with.
Jack, Andrea's vocabulary is way past mine, but I'm getting that fullness just in the smell here, but that kind of delicate edge on it that is easy to go to violets with. Let's go. Crushed blueberry, raspberry, juicy texture, well-integrated toast, a blast of pure fruit on the finish. Here we go. Oh, wow. There's a lot. Jack, is that even banana in there, Jack?
It does a heck of a lot in there. If the other one was lingerie for the tongue, this one is like shaking hands with a gaucho. I mean, it's a real, it's got a little something to it.
Yeah, it sure does. Now, a Malbec, John, this is a blended wine.
Would it be? Drinking from Argentina is pure. This is an example of globalization helping by smoothing out some of the rough edges of fairly rustic winemaking, and Malbec in Argentina now is becoming great. I've got one of my best friends in France was going through boot camp, and they did like a 25-mile march, and they stopped at the town of Cahors, C-A-H-O-R-S, which is upstream from Bordeaux. That's the one place in France where they make pure Malbec. And the wines from Argentina are beginning to resemble the Malbecs of the pure Malbecs of France, and which are also becoming a little better known. So I remember he and I used to drink, and he always said, "This is my favorite wine. This is where I finished boot camp drinking this wine."
I can hear that. Our time grows so short, Andrea. I'm sorry we didn't have you longer, but you're one of the top sommeliers in this country. When you read back on Jefferson, and I'm sure you have, what's the debt we owe him when it comes to wine?
Well, you know, I think we all owe him the debt of really the tradition of certainly having it as part of your everyday life, treating it, treating it as something, as a special enhancement to the everyday. And that's what I think Americans don't do. We save it just for special occasions. That's why I really hearken back to the it doesn't have to be expensive to be good, because everyday dinner in Jefferson's, you know, lifestyle was worthy of wine. And certainly it's not sold in a single serving size except for in coach on airplanes. And so it's meant to be shared. And the idea that Jefferson had, that it's a beverage of moderation and a beverage of the fine table, is something that I hope is a tradition we can start to incorporate again.
Yet another debt to the founding father. John Heilman, author of Thomas Jefferson on Wine. It's been just great having you with us today. Thanks for bringing the Jefferson wine tradition to life for us. Thank you so much.
Oh, terrific. I really enjoyed it, Tom. It was great.
and Andrea Robinson, a master sommelier, author of Andrea Robinson's 2007 Wine Buying Guide for Everyone. Andrea, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Tanya Raleigh, thanks for pouring. Great selection. Thanks
Anytime.
For bringing it in. And Jack, I think I could savor this the rest of the day.
I think I will. Here's to Jefferson, his mule, and his palate.
Oh, Thomas. Thanks, Jack. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.